Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, everybody, let's hang tight and look for landing radar.
Flight guidance.
No guidance.
We'll need that landing radar by 18,000 with this soundtrack.
Roger.
On the pings.
Roger, I copy guidance.
Okay,
we got data back.
Radar flight looks good.
Roger.
2,000 feet.
Roger. 2,000 foot del H. Your gun goes based on the data you had for an LOS. I see we got it back. Give you another few seconds.
We're yelling fine.
Okay, retro.
Go.
Vital.
Go.
Guide.
Go.
Control.
Go.
Telcom.
Go.
Jinsey.
Go.
Ecom.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Capcom. We're go to continue. PDI.
Coming to you live from the ghost-filled Sierra Nevada gold country in Shingle Springs, California, this is your host, John Almada.
It's a Friday night here, not too long before Halloween, or as some of those Wiccan folks say, Samhain, the time of the dead, and the time when the veil between the worlds is a little bit thinner. And so we're hoping that a lot of folks out there are maybe seeing a little bit more. There's a few more ghosts out there making their appearances, and we know we've had our cases of things here happening. As a matter of fact, just not more than about 3 minutes ago, I was sitting here in the studio in pre-show checks and making sure everything was going good, and lo and behold, I got the knocks on the door again. There's nobody there. And so my friends, I think, that are here on the property, my unseen friends, kind of let me know that they like what we do here, and we just keep going on with Ghost Rider Paranormal Radio and Ghost Rider Investigation. Speaking of that, we're going to be doing couple of investigations. It's been a rough 6 or 7 weeks. Excuse me, still coughing a little bit. Had that horrible H1N1 virus that kind of took us out. The whole family was knocked down on their butts here earlier in the month. But we're coming out of it, and we're going to be doing some hunts, though, here for the GRI team, of which I lead. And we're going to be heading out tomorrow on a private case out in the Sacramento area. And meet my team in Folsom, and we're going to go out and sit down and work it all out. Got some new members. Things are looking up for GRI. We've got a lot of new activity, a lot of new things coming our way. Oddly enough, some media attention coming in, and we're not quite sure how to handle that. I'm not used to the regular media having an interest in little old us. So going to be working that out. The other thing that's going on is we're going to be heading on the 30th out to the Truckee Hotel. And oddly enough, I found out just recently that my family, a member of my family, had a very violent incident in that hotel. So we're going to be going there and rename our team. Our psychic on the team is going to be kind of out there with me, and I believe her boyfriend will be there. Still trying to get a few other members to come with us, but we're going to get what we get and head up there. I'm going to run some video and a few things like that and lay out a whole lot of audio recorders, and we'll see how we do there. Quite a bit of activity reported in the Truckee Hotel. So we're thanking Tim, the proprietor up there, is having us in, and I'm going to be talking with him more this week about some of that, and we've already done some initial case research and things like that with regard to that. That said, still coughing here. Oh, boy. Tonight, a repeat guest, somebody we've really come to enjoy having on the show. It's Elizabeth Egan Cox, and she is a pretty interesting author and one fascinating lady. She's done a lot of interesting things with regard to paranormal research and been all over the place with doing the authoring and that kind of thing. Has a lot of interest in people's ancestry. Very good at that. And tonight she also reveals an interest in that she's going to share with us about grave art. And you know what I'm talking about. You go out to the average graveyard and you get out there and walk around, and it's always amazing and always very entertaining to see what people leave on their stone for their last message to the world and the theme that they leave. So, up here in the Sierra Nevadas where I live, we go out to these pioneer cemeteries, of which we have many, and you find these whole families have themes and similar gravestones, if not almost exactly the same, and they tend to carry on in these themes, and they have amazingly endearing writings. Others are terse and to the point and very businesslike. Others are just mysterious. And some religious, so it runs the gamut just like people do. So we're going to find out more from her about this and have her on. She's going to be on roughly at 20 minutes after the hour. And the thing I like about Elizabeth, she's a great person to interview because all you have to do is just ask a couple of questions and, man, she takes off with it. So we're going to have that going on. Chat room not too busy tonight. It could be that people are out partying on a Friday night. Well, you know, so We'll be taking whoever we get out there. If we get a few people want to pop on in and give us a yell, definitely feel free to. Phone number to call in for people listening in, it's 646-478-0377. And I'm going to read off some of Elizabeth's links here, too, by the way. For those of you interested in Elizabeth herself, her URL is www.elizabethegancox, that's Elizabeth, EAGANCOX.net. It's www.elizabethegancox.net. And we're going to have a few other things here, that she's going to be talking about with some of the different things about finding people, finding stones and graves and things like that. Things to help you in your search for maybe loved ones and people that are out there that, you're trying to find out where maybe a famous person is buried or, more about, where your relatives are at or people you know or might have remembered from the past. So she's going to be really getting into that. And let's see, a little bit of paranormal news. Saw out here the TOC blog, this is Time Out Chicago, had a brief interview with the boys, Grant and Jay, and it's titled Ghost Hunters, 3 Minutes with the Paranormal Research. And it says here, before going to the Ghost Hunters live presentation at Harper College last night, I knew that the sci-fi show was popular. I even knew that America's Favorite Plumbers turned ghoul getters were leading the ratings among paranormal-themed shows. But I had no clue how large and zealous their fan base is. The day after Ghost Hunters aired its investigation of the Congress Theater, more than 1,500 people flooded the Harper College gymnasium. Though I'd only planned on attending the show, the Harper PR rep gave me 3 on-the-fly minutes with Jason Hawes and Grant Wilson before the show began, and thankfully they were pretty cool about answering a few questions from a totally unprepared reporter. And the reporter here goes, "You guys seem to have had a huge fan base and an equally huge group out to debunk you. Does that bother you?" And Grant replied, he laughed, and he says, "No, that's what we want. We want everybody to be a skeptic. We're skeptics. Otherwise, we wouldn't be trying to debunk this stuff. We encourage people to ask questions, and actually, at the last place we spoke, our girl who couldn't have been older than 9 stood up at the end of our presentation and asked, yeah, but have you seen any real paranormal stuff? And I thought that was great. That was the best question we've gotten so far. So this article, if you just search out on Yahoo or go out on Google, which I use mostly, just Google the news and look for ghost hunters, and you'll see this article out there. A lot of neat stuff in there. I did want to talk briefly. Excuse me, still getting over that cough. I did want to talk briefly about some of the shows that have been recently on. Speaking of that Ghost Hunters episode, there was, I think they were in a prison here in one of the, either the last show or the last show before that, where they had some activity that they picked up in this this prison, and one of the doors was open. They walked off to the side of it. I think Grant was to the left of this door, and he turned around and walked away, and the camera was pointing away, and the door closed. And what was nice about this, and it's not something you see an awful lot of, is but there was a lot of corroborating evidence in the terms of alternate angles on the same event. So multiple cameras picked up the same event. And we were, you know, just really smiling, and you know, in our family, I mean, we were watching this episode, and I just loved it because, for once, one of these things got caught where you had, a full view of the entire event, and it was pretty clear that this was not just some normal event, and that, if somebody was faking it, they would have really had to go out of their way. And that thing slammed with some force. So we were rather pleased with them, you know, what they did there, and I just hope that they do more of that kind of thing. Another show that is out there that I'm finding to be extremely interesting, and just there's only been one on so far, and I think maybe my TiVo's recorded the second one, but I'm going to talk about Extreme Paranormal, and these guys... You know, I thought the Ghost Adventures crew were out there, but these guys, they were doing actually pagan ritual and magical rituals combined with paranormal research and pushing it to the limit. And this guy was even cutting himself and using his own blood in this prison, and they set fire in a spot where a person had died, caused all sorts of events to happen. I don't know. I'm just a bit too tame in the investigation field, but man, I mean, you are, you know, when you're doing work with some of the symbols and different things that, of those particular traditions, and believe me, I'm pretty familiar with this stuff. It does work, but I just think that, you know, combining that with paranormal research and then opening yourself up for, you know, a possible attack or being, have an attachment on you is, that's just taking it too far. And somebody is going to get hurt in one of these things. And so I look at it and I just think, wow, this has gone a little over the edge. I'm just thinking that it's just a little too much. So, you know, I don't know how much longer those guys are going to be able to investigate at the rate they're going. It's just... I don't know. The one time that I did provoke and actually got threatened the way I was, and it was pretty clear the spirit meant what he said when I played back the EVPs. You know, that's it got my attention. But when you look at what these guys are doing, it eclipses it by many magnitudes, what I did. And so that's the kind of thing I think that goes a little too far. Now, oddly enough, a replay happened here recently of Ghost Adventures at the Ancient Ram Inn. Now, there's another place that's up there on the Richter scale when it comes to paranormal events. I mean, the Most Haunted went out there and basically got their butts kicked out there. That was a couple of years ago, and I think it kind of put that place on the map as the Most Haunted episode. And I guess, Ghost Adventures crew decided that was going to be, one of their piece de resistance type cases where they were going to just take it to the limit. And believe me, a place like that that's had pagan ritual and the things that were done there for thousands of years is obviously going to have strong residual energy and obviously, you know, possibly quite a set of intelligent presences inhabiting the area. And it's pretty obvious the owner doesn't just come by all these ritual objects in there by accident. He's bringing them in and taking an already, you know, tough situation and making it a lot worse by bringing all this stuff in. So he's obviously has an interest in this. Well, they go in, you know, and did a circle, did a ritual themselves, stepped in against the advice of the the Wiccan priestess there, and was actually, you know, they actually invited these things into them. And, you know, that's just, again, that's going a little bit too far. I just don't know. I'm real fans of both shows. I think Extreme Paranormal is going to be on for a while, Ghost Adventures. You know, they filmed quite a few episodes, but they've gone kind of into this hiatus state, and I don't know what's going on with them, but their shows are extremely popular. I like to watch them do their thing. I wouldn't want to be them. We're in their network, GRI's in the network with them, and I kind of keep an eye on their website to see what's going on, and probably will check it out tonight when I get done with the show tonight. So, you know, I just want to warn people, you know, when you see this stuff on TV, and it looks good to you, that, you know, and exciting, and you think that that's the way things are done, it's, you know, by and large, and most of us, the rest of us in this business are a little more conservative. We want to be around a long time, you know, and, you know, it's interesting to see what the limits are and to see where the boundaries are, and these people are doing that for us. And a tip of the hat to them. I'm all for that, but I really think that there's just some things that shouldn't be messed with, and you know, they're gonna pay the price for that. So as a matter of fact, briefly just returning back to, I just saw something. One of the questions here that Grant was being talked about. The interviewer says somebody actually pulled a gun on you guys. And Grant Wilson says, yeah, we were checking out this woman's house and she pulled a shotgun out on us. Unfortunately, she also committed suicide 6 months later. We didn't put that show on, but it happened. And then it was showtime, and Grant Hawes and Wilson entered the gym to find a sea of fans sporting Ghost Hunters T-shirts and applauding thunderously. And it goes on to talk about their case and the different things. But that's something else, that somebody actually would do that and then kill themselves 6 months later. You wonder what was going on paranormally with regard to that. Now, I'm not seeing a lot of activity in the chat room, so I'm going to just take a guess that there might be a problem with the chat, and I'm going to restart just in case anybody is trying to get in, and I'll go ahead and pop that in a new window in the middle of Firefox, the browser of GRI. So we're going to go ahead and let that run, see if we can get that to go, and sure enough, it's starting properly. And we're going to have Elizabeth Egan Cox dialing in about roughly 3-4 minutes. So we're going to be looking for her. As a matter of fact, I see her out there. So we've got that going. I'm going to go ahead and probably introduce her in. So I'm going to read her bio and then go ahead and pop her on here after I get done. Elizabeth Egan Cox has penned dozens of corporate histories for some of America's most prestigious companies, including the Ayers Hotel Group, Billabong USA, Cabo Yachts, Forever 21, Matsushita Avionics, and the TXI Cement Manufacturing Company. And she was a columnist for Old California Gazette, and she is a former school librarian. She enjoys digging up intriguing stories about history and incorporating these facts in her writing. And she sent me a couple of her books that I read, the Shannon Delaney series, and I can't wait to get the third and fourth books. Book one of Ghost of a Chance, and then book two, A Ghost from the Shadows. She used a lot of elements of history, excuse me, to bring the story to life, including the study of the late 19th century sleight of hand magic, Victorian architecture, craftsman bungalow architecture, and details regarding California's founding Hispanic culture. And in book three, A Ghost Meets an Angel, which is with the publisher, Cambridge Books, eBooks on the Net, and it's going to be issued in late 2009 and early 2010. Paperback edition is going to be out in about 6 months. And I didn't realize she was on book four, but she's really cranking along. She's going to be having book four of the Shannon Delaney Cozy Paranormal Mystery Series basically being written then. So she's probably already working on the outlines and stuff. Elizabeth is also a member of the National Society of the Daughters of the American Revolution and a worldwide Irish Clan Mac. I can't even say that. Egan? Clan Egan. Aye. And if you want to go see Clan Egan, www.clanegan.org. She's also an author. As an author, she's a member of the Sisters in Crime in Industries Professional Organization for Women who write mysteries and crime fiction, and she resides in California. So, you know, check her site out, www.elizabetheegancox.net. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and pick up the phone. It's 8:20, so we're right on the mark with having her in. And I hope we have Elizabeth on the line.
You do. Good evening.
Hey, it's good to have you back. Welcome aboard again.
Well, thank you so much, John. And, gosh, I hope you're not coming down with a cold.
Actually, I'm recovering. Excuse me. I'm recovering from H1N1.
My family.
Yeah, basically the first half of this month, we were flat on our backs. My mother got it, and I got it at the same time, and with my sick father, it took the two of us crawling around like a couple of dogs there, holding each other up, and it was not a lot of fun. So I've got this cough that stays around for about, you know, 4 or 5 weeks of all things. So I'm still coughing, and but I feel pretty good. You know, it's just my voice sounds like I've been got a gravel in it. So sorry about that. I'm doing the best I can.
That's okay. I'll just try and do more talking, so you won't have.
Well, I totally appreciate that. As a matter of fact, I kind of mentioned earlier in the show I was banking on that because of the way my voice is. I've got the coffee ready, and I'm just going to sit and listen. But you know, I hope you heard I was reading off your. Basically your bio and the books and talked about what you're doing with your books. I was surprised to see you're going to start book four.
What I call actively write. I actively write March through October. My goal each year is to have the new book on my editor's desk by October 15th because, as I think I've told you, we always go on our annual vacation over Halloween week. And I don't want that hanging over my head while I'm on vacation. Now, I will come right back from vacation, and my editor and I will start going back and forth playing volleyball, editing book three. But book three, which is called A Ghost Meets an Angel, will be out in ebook. Gosh, my publisher has targeted December 1st. For the ebook, and then the paperback does follow in about 5 to 6 months. So it's not like, you know, from November until March when I'm actively writing, I'm not doing something. I'm doing a lot of editing because the ebook edition has to be edited separately from the paperback edition. And during that time, I'm also doing research. But March 1st every year, I sit down at my keyboard and I start chapter one. I'm very regimented when I'm actively writing like that. But thank you for that intro. I really appreciate it. You didn't skip a beat, and you did pretty well there on trying to pronounce my name. It is Clan MacEgan, and that's actually the original Irish spelling of my name, Egan, E-A-G-A-N. I use the more Americanized, simplified spelling of it. And you know, that kind of goes along with the whole topic tonight, which is grave art, because when you go around looking at gravestones, you've got to keep in mind how the original spelling might have been for the name. And gosh, you know, that goes all the way back in all cultures and in the great diversity that we have here in the U.S., in North America in general. All of our names started off being spelled something entirely different than what they are now. So.
Yeah, I kind of know what you mean. I in some of the research I did on my family, kind of right after the show, I got into, you know, that I had you on last. I got into that, and I've had to stop for a little bit, but I made a lot of progress, and I found out things about my family name that I had no friggin' idea. It was just. I'm just still kind of stunned at what we picked up, and I found evidence of my family in the most unlikely places. So I wanted to thank you because you kind of helped me find a lost family history that Of all places, I found it on Google Books.
You just never know. And real quick, because you did mention that I'm a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, beloved in American society as the DAR. But what I would like to point out is that I was the very first person in my family to connect all of the dots generation to generation, going all the way back to Virginia and the Carolinas of the 1700s, to find and document with evidence I'm related directly to four men who are Revolutionary War patriots. And what I like to tell people is that my story is not unique. Anyone can do this. And, you know, kiddingly and jokingly, I have appeared on other radio shows, and I think even on yours, telling people that if you find your ancestors, you do find your ghosts. And since you've read my books, you know that I have ghost characters in my books, and I treat them as characters. They are not novelties. Because I do believe in ghosts, and I believe in spirit visitation, and I know that in my personal life, the spirit visitations have been from my past relatives. And I realize I'm kind of on my soapbox here, but bear with me. Mm-hmm. I believe often if you feel that there is a spirit around you, that it's best to go looking for your past relatives first. And in most cases, the only ones you're going to know about will be the most recent generations. And it could go back further than that. It could be relatives that you are not aware of. And if this sounds sort of out there and on the edge, I tell people to think about how their own lives are right now. And that the people you love in your life right now, do you really think that that love is going to die if you die? And so, you know, if you think about it in that perspective, when you are out, you know, digging up your ancestors, you could be getting in touch with your own spirit visitations. And that's kind of where the whole grave art topic for tonight comes into play, because many people go out and they look at gravestones, and other than the pertinent information, the data, the statistics that's going to be on there as far as, you know, a person's name, date of birth, date of death. However, sometimes it will only give an age range. There's other clues to that gravestone, and those clues are really absolutely fascinating. And so I'm going to be giving out some really good free resources that are on the internet that anyone can use. And whether you just have an interest in the whole phenomenon of grave art, or if you find yourself in a cemetery and you're not quite sure what to do while you're there, studying grave art is really a fascinating aspect to our culture, and it spans over all cultures and all diversity.
The thing that struck me, you know, just thinking about this tonight, I went back and I looked at some of my photographs, because I've done a lot of cemetery work, and the themes that I see, you know, you see every socioeconomic stratus, I can hardly say the word today because my voice is gone, but every socioeconomic status reflected, you see, you know, their belief systems, the senses of humor. Those are the ones I love the best, the humorous ones who kind of, you know, poke a little fun at things as a last parting shot. Or the serious ones, and then the ones who are, you know, just sort of mysterious in some of the messages they leave. So I know you're going to talk about all of that. You know, just take it from there. I mean, let's just dive in.
Okay, real quick, I need to let you know and others know, I am not on the internet right now. I'm down in a cozy little area of a basement room that's very quiet, and I'm down here for that reason. And I do have a clock I'm looking at, and so I'm going to ask you, how much time do we have?
I'm not going to take any breaks tonight.
Okay.
So we have 1 hour from now, 1 hour and 15 seconds.
Okay,
so
great. We go
have
there.
At it.
9:30. All right. Well, one of the first things I want to kind of define, because in today's society we use two words, cemetery and graveyard, almost currently, but going back throughout history of funerals and burials, graveyard and cemetery stood for something entirely different, And it was like that right up until about World War II. A lot that was done in our society in regard to burials and funerals changed drastically around World War I and then again in World War II. And the reason for that is because in each of those situations, our troops went overseas into Europe and other areas, and they brought back customs and language and vocabulary that became incorporated into North American culture. And so World War I and World War II are key periods when our culture has changed. Up until World War I, the word cemetery meant a public burial ground. Now, public burial grounds usually were, they were public. They were, excuse the crass term, they were the town boneyard. And boneyard really was a term that was used. They may have different segments within that cemetery that were denoted for particular religions or denominations, but generally speaking, anyone could be buried in a cemetery, including usually a back section that was the Potter's Field. Potter's Field was an area that was reserved for the people who, you know, they may not have had any family. They were in a financial situation that they could not afford a public funeral. These usually were individual graves, but sometimes they were kind of a public pit. And I know that sounds horrible, but, you know, that's the way it was. Graveyard. Graveyard historically has always meant that the burial ground is either on a church ground or it is designated by a particular church. And by church, I mean a denomination of a religion. You know, I travel often back into the southern colonial states because that is where my ancestry is. And once you get back into those colonial states and you visit churches, whether it's the old Anglican churches or some of the older Puritan churches up in New England, you will have the gravestones just a stone's throw from walking into the sanctuary. That is your very typical colonial 1700, 1800 churchyard. That would be a graveyard. But as the population or the parish or the congregation for that church grew, then the churchyard kind of grew out from the church, and it might would be on a neighboring piece of land, often across the street. The church would then buy the property across the street, and the burials would continue over there. So keep in mind, anyone who's going to do this, if you go to an area and it actually says graveyard, or you come across family documents, or if you're doing paranormal investigation and you come across documents that says that the deceased was buried in a graveyard, then you're going to be looking for a very particular denomination of a religion. Now, all of that started to change around World War I. Around World War I, we had always had cemetery national parks, but around World War I, we probably had more we probably had a greater need for military burials than at any other time, in the sense that we needed national parks. And so more national parks came into being. And when you're dealing with a national park, you are dealing with, first of all, a military burial, so you know that that person was a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And unless the family has particularly requested that the soldier receive a specified denomination for whatever religion the soldier or the soldier's family is, then it's going to be a very basic, uniform type of gravestone. In many cases, it's a simple cross. If the soldier was Christian, and that means Christian of all denominations.
Yeah.
If the soldier was Jewish, it might be a very simple Star of David. Those are the two most common you will come across in a military burial park or national park in America. So once, you know, once once you understand that there could be a very particular inference between a cemetery and a graveyard. And one that I would like to caution people for is that if you come across family members in the same location, you know, the same city or the same county, and the predominantly those family members are buried in a graveyard associated with a particular church or denomination, and then you find others that aren't, they're buried in the public cemetery, that should be a red flag. Because that tells you that either by choice, the person who was buried in the cemetery did not want to be associated with that church or denomination, or for whatever reason, they behaved in such a way that they became an outcast of that church and denomination, and they were not allowed to be buried in the church graveyard. So that's a red flag I'd like to draw everyone's attention to. And now we're going to go right into funeral customs. And the reason we're going into funeral customs before we go into graveyard art is because you need to understand that the diversity in North America requires, now by law, it requires that morticians know about very specific funeral customs. I actually have a book on this. It came out of the California State Mortician Association. I wrote to them and I was able to buy this. But that's not a book that everyone would want. So what I'm going to do is direct everyone to this free website. It is, I'm going to say it and then I'm going to spell it out. It is www.religionlink.com, and that is www.religionlink.com. From the front page, there is a search box up in the top right corner. And what I would tell everyone to do is to type in the two words, funeral customs. And then up will come a short list of results. And from that short list of results, you choose an article that is called The Transformation of American Funerals. And from that article on Transformation of American Funerals, you're going to find a great diversity that will give you information on how funeral customs, say for instance within the Jewish community, have changed over the years, and also the different divisions within the Jewish community. One of them that I've always found absolutely fascinated is what we generally call in American society or popular cultural gypsies. And,
yeah.
Okay. Traditionally, it would be Romani. And what I'm going to tell everyone now is that you need to know that when you're talking about the gypsies of folklore, we are talking about the Romani culture that came out of Eastern Europe. However, you also have Scottish and Irish gypsies, which technically are called travelers. And there are also English and Welsh gypsies, which are called tinkers. And so if you're looking for a gypsy and you think that that person was Irish or Scottish, you want to pay attention to the term travelers. And if, you know, they came out of England or Wales, you want to pay attention to the term tinkers. And what's so fascinating is about in the gypsy culture, when you're going out and you're looking at graveyard art and tombstone art, what you're going to look for would be something, for instance, with tinkers, you might actually see what today, especially out here in the Southwest, you might would mistake for a typical covered wagon, you know, like the covered wagons that came west. Well, in actuality, that was probably a tinker's wagon, and you want to look really close at it because you might find here or there a tea kettle or a pot or a pan hanging off of it, and that will be the clue that it was a tinker. And if it was a tinker, then you're going to be looking for an English or a Welsh name and an English or a Welsh history of it. One of the things that you would look for instance, with the gypsy culture, is that they often had very elaborate gravestones because that was tradition within their culture to do, this kind of reminds me of what goes on in New Orleans, to have a very elaborate show of passion and grief, and that would come into play within the art. And you'll find things such as elaborate wreaths of flowers or flowers etched into the gravestone, and those flowers are draping over, almost as if the flowers are grieving. But that's just one of the highlights that you can come across in doing a research on religionlink.com. Once again, at the top right corner in the search box, you're going to type in funeral customs. Up will come a very short list, and you go to the article that is titled The Transformation of American Funerals, and you will find a great diversity there. The other one I wanted to talk about, because we're talking about graves, well, you have to find a grave first. And
yeah.
There's this wonderful free website. It is called findagrave.com. I'll spell that out. www.findagrave.com. Now, there's many different kinds of searches you can do on this website, but if you're looking for a particular name, and I tell paranormal investigators that this is really handy if you're investigating a particular area or a particular family or even a building, often the people who own the property that you're going out to investigate may not be aware of where either their relatives are buried, or if you're trying to do a research on former owners of the building.
Yeah.
This is a really great thing to do. You can go to the surname list, and you can either do a search under a list of surnames, just like looking in like a telephone directory. But the other thing that I recommend is that you can type in a surname and do a list that way, or do a research that way. I caution everyone to always remember to use many, many different phonetic spellings when you're looking for any particular surname. And pay very close attention to surnames that may have prefixes in front of them. Certainly with all the Irish and Scotch surnames, you may have to have the M-A-C or the M-C in front of the name. In the German and Dutch names, you may have to have the V-A-N, van, or V-O-N inserted in front of the name. And with many of the Latin-based names, especially coming out of Spain, and even many of the California Hispanics have maintained the authentic spelling of their Spanish surnames, in which case you may have the small D-E in front of the surname. And so that's the kind of thing that you want to look for. However, findagrave.com is fun because you can also look up people. So, you know, if you've forgotten where Elvis is buried, you can look up Elvis or any other famous person. This is especially helpful if you're going to go to a particular area. Now, I'm getting ready to spend my Halloween in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And my husband, you know, has relatives from the Civil War at Gettysburg, and we recently were using Find a Grave to locate them. So that's a fun thing to do if you are out looking for haunted areas, and you know you're going to be traveling to a particular area. You can also do a search according to town, county, and state. And you don't have to know the county. You can just type in the town. So people coming out to Hollywood, this is a fun thing to do if you're coming out to Southern California and you're going to be in Hollywood, is type in Hollywood, California, and up will come all the various cemeteries in Hollywood, California. And you can go to the individual cemeteries, and you can just look and see who's buried there. You don't have to do a individual name search. But this is especially handy if you are doing genealogical research and you absolutely do not know where your family is buried. You can do it on a state-by-state basis, or you can do an entire by nation basis. However, I recommend that you try doing it state by state, or narrowing it as, you know, as best you can by county or city, and just narrow it that way. So often with Find a Grave, what will happen if you're looking for a particular person, the person's data will come up, and in many cases the actual photographs of the gravestone will come up. Find a Grave also serves another purpose. You can search according to different eras, and up will come gravestones from that era. And so it's a good research tool if you're trying to define when a gravestone may date to. You know, many gravestones are weathered, and it's difficult sometimes to find the exact information on that gravestone, and you're trying to zero in on a particular date. This is another situation where looking at the art on that gravestone will help you determine the date of the other gravestone, the one that may not
be.
Yeah. This is really handy, and people forget to do it that way. This is sort of the equivalent of trying to identify, you know, you come across photos of people, and you're going, gosh, you know, I don't know, was this the 1930s or the 1920s? And I didn't give you this website. I think I may have given it to you before. It's called Dead Fred. It is www.deadfred.com. And Dead Fred is to trying to identify what people look like by what they were wearing in the photograph, the way Find a Grave is trying to figure out when that grave was actually erected by the gravestone art. Okay. You know, if anyone out there ever has questions, they're welcome to. Do you have like a chat room that they can ask questions in, John?
Yeah, I've got, we're kind of light on the guests in there on the chat room. We've got two. We've got one unnamed guest, and then my good buddy Kathy back in the East Coast is on with us. So,
okay.
Any of you guys who want to throw a question our way, feel free. And my printer just decided to do something weird. It was interesting. Every once in a while, as a matter of fact, pre-show, I had my customary knocks on the wall from those who are not around. Kind of letting me know they like the they like what I'm doing. It's we're on this haunted ranch, and so they always let me know, and it's always during the show or just before. So, but anyway, they were messing. I think somebody was messing with my printer. It just decided to go. So
maybe they're trying to put in a request to, you know, to have someone their grave.
Well, you know, what's funny is, I mean, everything you're saying, I've never really realized that, you know, it's almost like forensics, you know, the Dead Fred thing, and then the whole thing of the art, you know, being able to be, be used as kind of a pointer to, you know, to date things. I never ever thought of that. So, I mean, this is good stuff.
It is good stuff. And it not only applies to people who are interested in their own genealogy, but it truly does apply to anyone who's serious about paranormal investigation, because I would imagine sooner or later you're going to find yourself walking through a cemetery or a graveyard. And it's hard to tell by the material that a gravestone is made out of in order to date it, because so much of the materials have been used the same throughout centuries, you know, whether it's some kind of a marble or some kind of a granite. Those are the two most common. And they're still used today, so it's almost impossible to date it that way. But yes,
yeah.
The artwork, which I'm going to get into a little bit right now, because the frame of reference that we have today is very different compared to what you're going to find on artwork of graves going back through various decades. The most romantic era for artwork on a grave is certainly the Victorian era, throughout the entire 1800s, and actually that went into the early 1900s. Grief at that time was something that was often displayed on gravestones, and the grave art can be very intricate and by our standards today, it could be very easily misinterpreted. One of the things that I have noticed, I mean, I think I've told you before, I certainly do tread lightly through graveyards, and I've been through some that date to the late 1600s and 1700s. In Virginia, in the Tidewater area of Virginia, there's this little church called St. Peter's Parish Church. It was built in 1700. It still stands today. It's an active parish, and I have visited that church. My family helped to build it in 1700, and they're listed on the vestry records.
Wow.
So when you're looking at, and this is one of the classic examples of the gravestones are actually a stone's throw from the sanctuary. Yeah, I mean, they're right there. And some of the things that I have noticed is that, especially with the 1800s, because that's the era that people just become so fascinated. You walk through the cemeteries and you have larger-than-life angel statuary. You will have three-dimensional type of gravestone art. One of them that comes to mind is that you may see a broken column. And often that column is your traditional Roman-style column, you know, thinking back to the Greco-Roman period, the great architecture out of Athens, Greece, and in Rome, Italy, that very classic style of column that you still see today in courthouses and libraries. And the column is broken, and people immediately will think that it's been vandalized, but actually the column was made to look broken because it signified that it was the head of the family. And not just the head of the family in the sense that it was the father in a single family residence. We are talking about the patriarch of the family. And so that's the kind of thing that you would look out for. Along that same, you might see on top of a gravestone in a three-dimensional form a circle that is broken or it is cracked. And it was made to be broken. And often that circle, you know, I tell people, you know, just imagine a big loop, and it looks like somebody took a chunk out of it. And it also was made to look that way. And this is a real red flag. It means that that person who is laid to rest under that gravestone that has this broken circle, well, family ties were severed by that person. That's the person you're most likely to find buried in a cemetery and not the graveyard of the church. And so that red flag is going to tell you that there is some family history there. We're talking about drama in the family, if you ever come across that. That's still used today, not so much in the three-dimensional form, but you might see it etched on a gravestone, a circle that it looks like a chunk has been just broken, as if you took a piece of concrete that was a circle, a ring, and it dropped and a chunk fell out of it. So if you see that either in a three-dimensional form or etched on a gravestone, realize that there is a red flag there that should be investigated. There's going to be some kind of fascinating history behind it. Another symbol that I come across that can be misinterpreted is just a hand holding a hand axe, and it looks like it's in a chopping motion. Well, that is not an indication that the person was a lumberjack. It's an indication that that person died of sudden, immediate death. It could be a murder. It could be an accident. But it was something that was sudden and totally unpredictable. So once again, it's a red flag. We're not talking about someone who was known to have heart disease and then, you know, had a massive heart attack. We're talking about someone who died very suddenly and violently. Another red flag.
I want to ask a question. These cases that you're talking about, it just seems to me that you know, the average family is not just going to think of this at the time of the, you know, the death of any of these things. It's going to be something communicated to them. So somebody is keeping these traditions and then passing it at the moment of, you know, the greatest stress,
yeah.
You know, talking to the family and then presenting these options, and then it's being chosen.
Yes, and to be honest, usually it would be the minister, the rector, the minister.
Yeah.
It's going to be whoever was their religious or spiritual advisor in the situation. And many families, you know, one of the other things I want to caution people about, regardless of what their religion or spiritual beliefs are today, they need to realize that really right up until the 1960s, until the whole flower power movement and all of that, people were extremely religious. And regardless of how you might feel today about your religion or spiritual beliefs, chances are when you walk through a cemetery, you are going to see a great diversity of religion and spiritual beliefs being played out on these gravestones. And in most cases, it was whoever their spiritual or religious advisor was. And so once again, you're going to look toward whatever religious affiliation the family had. And that kind of goes right into when you look at gravestones, you may see initials, and those initials can be very easily misinterpreted by today's standards. And actually, I think I might be jumping ahead just a little bit, but we'll come back to it. For instance, out here in Southern California, someone had contacted me, and they said, Elizabeth, what does UCV stand for? And I told them that stands for United Confederate Veteran. And they go, how can that be? This is California. And I told them, I said, well, there were lots of places out here in California that were pioneered and colonized by Southerners. In Southern California, the mountain town of Julian was founded by Southerners who came out here after the Civil War. You know, the South was just ravaged and Reconstruction did not work, so they came west like many other people did. That's the kind of thing that people may attach into their present day frame of reference, something completely different than what it stands for. So I'm kind of jumping ahead right now, and I want to refer people to this absolutely incredible website called hereditary.us. I'm going to spell that www.hereditar.us. And what this site is, from the menu on the left, you pick society lists. And what this site does is give you a list of all sorts of fraternal organizations as well as hereditary organizations as well as religious associations. So whenever you come across initials, before you maybe interpret it according to your own frame of reference in present-day terms, go to this website and find out what those initials might stand for. Another one that came across recently over my desk, someone emailed me, and I forget right now what the initials were, but the initials stood for Descendants of Salem Witches. I kid you not, this is so mind-boggling. There is an order of people who descended from the Salem witch trial witches. And one person said to me, but okay, those people were, you know, they were stoned to death, they were hung, you know, how can there be descendants? Well, many of the people who died during the horrific Salem witches were actually parents. You know, I mean, they did have descendants. And I also want to caution, just because it says descendants doesn't mean it's a direct lineage descendant. It may have been an aunt, an uncle, a cousin. We call that in genealogy, we call that collateral lineage. you know, so that's the other kind of thing that you want to pay very close attention to.
Yeah.
Going through the society list at hereditary.us is an education in and of itself of the great diversity here in North America. Because when you look through gravestones, you'll come across all sorts of initials. One that I know I come across all the time is KT. Lots of people recognize that now because of the whole angels and demon things, you know, that whole book and movie. KT can stand for Knights Templar, but it might also stand for Knights Tabor. And you will find all sorts of organizations under the whole Knights of phenomena, not just Knights Templar. You'll find Knights of St. Patrick, Knights of St. Columbus, you know, and so on and so on and so on. So that's the other kind of thing you want to pay very close attention to. Whenever you're doing gravestone studies, you've got to keep in mind that our vocabulary has evolved and changed over time. I was just telling this to some paranormal investigators that two words that have changed drastically over time that may show up in EVPs is the word Jesse. And notice I said the word Jesse, not the name Jesse, but it's spelled the same. Because right up until, gosh, the end of the Old West, which really kind of went up until the 1920s when automobiles came into being very affordable and people decided they were going to retire Old Bessie, and Old Bessie, I mean a horse, is that Jesse was not necessarily a proper name. And I had come across an EVP that, to the best of the detection, people thought it either said, you're going to get Jesse, or go get Jesse, or something like that. And I said, well, you have to understand that right up until, well, actually even probably during the Roaring Twenties, the 1920s, if someone got Jesse, or somebody was going to go give Jesse, or they used the term, he's going to get Jesse, it meant they quite literally were going to get the living tar beat out of him. They were going to get a really, really good beating. You know, and that could be very surprising for someone. And the person who was trying to distinguish what the EVP is, now, you know what, I'm throwing the term EVP around. John, I'm presuming that, you know, most people know. Do you want to explain what an EVP is?
Yeah, that's our specialty here with what we do. It's electronic voice phenomena, and most of you have seen that on many of the paranormal shows. It's our primary evidence-gathering method. I use a wide variety of equipment, and I collect EVP recorders like I collect candy. Each one has different capabilities, but the theory is that ghosts and spirits are able to actually connect into the electronics, and this is a recent theory, as a matter of fact, because I'm a member of the American Association of EVP, and what they're saying is it's not the microphone that they're talking into most of the time. They're actually able to affect some of the silicon, the electronics, transistors, things like that, and directly interface with the recorder or a computer even or a telephone. So this is how they're able to imprint their voices into this gear. So that's what, in a real whirlwind tour here, EVP stands for. And as a matter of fact, Kathy did have a question for you on EVP. Basically, I think that she was just asking, I got to scroll back here, that she was asking about you. Do you do EVP? I mean, when you're out?
I do not do EVP, but thank you for asking that, because since we are going to Gettysburg, my husband has an interest in it. As I said, his family, he actually had family, ancestors, who were at Gettysburg, and he's going to try and use to maybe get some EVPs. I've made him promise not to ever have to do it in my home.
I totally agree. I totally agree with that because, you know, I was doing an EVP work here at the house, and I finally, it started inviting them in, and I started having more trouble than I knew what to do with, and I finally had to draw the line and tell them, okay, I'll only do that off the property or way off in the corner and not do it here in the house, because stuff started happening. It got nuts. So good idea. Very good. Matter of fact, I'll tell you what, I'll send you a link. I just posted on the GRI website a presentation that I give when I go out and do public presentations of best ways to record. It's got all the various classification schemes, all that. So if you go out on the GRI website and go out and look in our file download area, you'll see that is the first item on the list of files to download. It's PowerPoint, and you can download that, and it's chock full of things that you could, you know, they'll really benefit you. So your husband could use that.
Thank you. Thank you so very much. We will definitely do that. Getting back to the EVPs, I've had paranormal investigators contact me, usually through my email, like you have, John, when it comes to the whole vocabulary thing. And I know I just used the word Jesse as a classic example of that. Another word that comes up that someone had emailed me about is the word gum. And I've seen it used as gummed in like a past tense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, today when we think of gum, we think of bubble gum, we think of chewing gum. That actually didn't come about until the 1920s. Prior to that, the word gum meant that a person had gotten trapped, and trapped in not a good way. I mean, conned. Okay, trap, that kind. Not, you know, playing a trick on someone or a joke. So it was a very serious allegation that someone was gummed, or he's getting the gum. You know, and I know that in the case with the PI who asked me this, he said it sounds like gun, G-U-N. And you can understand, I mean, just over the phone today, gum and gun sound alike. So imagine what it could sound like in an EVP. And I told them that if the word is gum, realize we're not talking about blowing bubbles and chewing gum. We're talking about someone who was sort of ambushed or a very serious con into a situation that may have caused their death. So that's kind of a classic example of how not to interpret vocabulary and language on a present-day frame of reference. Anyone can ask me these questions through my website. You can email me through there. I have so many various writers' references. You know, I did study, I'm actually an American and California historian, and the 1800s is my expertise, but because my ancestry goes back to the 1700s, I have a passion for that as well. Our vocabulary, another thing that affects the vocabulary that you may find is that in colonial times, we only had 24 letters in the alphabet. The additional two letters did not happen until right around the 1920s when publishers wanted to standardize dictionaries.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, see, here's something else. Prior to that time, you know, we're all familiar with the name Thomas Jefferson. Prior to that time, if you saw Jefferson, you just had to know that those were F's and not S's because they stood for the same letter. U's and V's stood for the same letter. And so right up until the 1920s, our alphabet had only about 24 letters until it became nationally standardized. And that's the kind of thing that you want to watch out for. Now, as a historian and as an author in, you know, the Victorian era figures very prominently in my novel series because I have a magician who is a ghost, and he was a Victorian master magician of the 1800s, and he does turn out to be the reoccurring ghost and sort of spirit guide for my lead character, a young woman named Shannon Delaney. Well, I have all of these writers' references that normally people would not need to get, but if you are looking for something like that, what I tell people to do is go out and literally haunt the used bookstores and look for dictionaries and thesauruses. A thesaurus is what we commonly call today a synonym book, that were printed before 1920. And that really will help you, because you'll start to learn how our vocabulary has changed over the years. And if you're out there and you're doing either paranormal investigation, or for people who are interested in genealogy and you come across old documents, you need to kind of cross-reference those old documents with dictionaries authentic to the time period. And this where it kind of goes back to where I was talking about World War I and World War II. Our vocabulary here in the English-speaking world of North America, predominantly Canada and the U.S., didn't really start to change until after the first phase was World War I, where our troops came back from Europe and introduced new phraseology and new words to us. And then again in World War II, where once again our troops came back from, you know, a much broader spectrum of areas and began to introduce new words and phraseology to us. And so those are the kinds of things that you always want to keep in mind, whether you're going back and you're trying to locate what I call digging up your ancestors, finding your ghosts, or you're doing paranormal investigation. You always have to keep in mind the vocabulary that was used and symbols and artwork, because they could mean something totally different for that time period than what our frame of reference is today.
Okay.
Now, I was going to backtrack a little bit, because I had skipped one of the talking points that I had given you, and it's called Association of Gravestone Studies.
Yeah.
It's a website called gravestonestudies.org. I'm going to spell that www.gravestonestudies.org. From the front page, you want to scroll all the way down to the very, very, very bottom, and you will see a little term called site map. That is S-I-T-E, map, M-A-P. You want to click that on, and from that page, you want to choose the FAQ, the facts, or the frequently asked questions. And the FAQ page has general information. And on that page, there are articles pertaining to all sorts of grave art symbols, as well as all other sorts of information on gravestone studies, including information pertaining to the different materials that have been used for the making of a gravestone over the years, you know, that kind of thing. Because sometimes you may come across a gravestone that looks very, very old, because maybe it's been made out of weathered granite, when in actuality, it's fairly contemporary. Okay, the grave art symbols are divided, I think, into two different centuries, and you want to go through both of those centuries. These come up, I believe, in PDF, which is Adobe Acrobat, and you can print those up. So that's extremely handy for anyone doing genealogy or paranormal investigation. Just print them up and have them part of your regular, you know, research reference material. Under gravestone studies, you'll get into the different symbols as well as explanation of popular motifs that have been used during different centuries and during different eras. I went over a couple of those, you know, at the very beginning when I was talking about how a broken column was used by the family, a broken ring, a hand chopping, that kind of thing. But one of the other things you want to pay very close attention to are symbols, because some of those have remained very, very constant. For instance, a lamb is often used for children. Lily of the Valley is used for innocence. You know, today Lily of the Valley is very popular for bridal bouquets. Whereas in days gone by, right up until about World War II of the 1940s, a lily of the valley was almost always used for a child. A candle being snuffed out is indication of time and mortality. Butterfly. Today, butterflies are used almost as a new age kind of symbol. But once again, from the 1800s up through the 1940s, a butterfly symbolized a short-lived life, a premature death. That doesn't necessarily mean a child. It could have been a young adult. So, you know, those are just kind of a sample of some of the things. Another one would be a wreath. If you see a wreath, and to me this is where the whole concept of a funeral wreath came into being in the 1800s. If there was a death in the family, you would see a black wreath on their door. And in actuality, that wreath meant a victory over death. The person probably lived to be a very elderly age. The person was, he lived a very moral life. And if you lived to be a very elderly age and you were a very moral person, and I'm not talking an attitude, I'm talking about an actual practice of how you lived your life, then you were thought, you were believed to be, that you won a victory over death, that you were going certainly onto a better place. Angels, trumpeting angels, always represented resurrection. Now, however, just an angel in and of itself did not represent resurrection, but an angel in and of itself often represented the hope that the family had for that person, that they were going on to heaven or whatever was thought by that family to be the better place in the passing. Birds. Birds are very common. What you want to look out for are flying birds, because flying birds represented the flight of the soul. Some birds, by today's frame of reference, might represent something that seemed rather ominous. However, for instance, in my culture, which is the Celtic culture, if you were to see what could be interpreted as a raven or a crow, well, that also represented a journey that was going to end well. And this goes back to the whole concept. You know, the whole concept of what was called the crow's nest in sailing came about from the Irish saint, St. Brendan the Navigator. And I forget when St. Brendan lived. It was some, I think, in the 1200s. St. Brendan was told by his sister Brenda to take two ravens. Now, in the Celtic culture, a crow and a raven is the same thing. But to take two ravens, ravens mate for life. And so you were supposed to take the mated ravens and put them into a nest upon the tall staff, because the ravens would not leave that nest until they saw land. And so that's where the whole concept of a crow's nest on a ship came into being. So if you happen to see a raven or a crow and it's just perched, it means that that soul has landed on the other side. In a Celtic culture, there was the belief that our souls take flight and they land on the other side, and that other side would be heaven in our culture. So that's,
I really like that. I'm half Scottish Highlander, and you know what? That appeals to me somehow. I love that.
Yeah, you see, in the Celtic culture, the raven and the crow are very good symbols. Now, in many of the Native American cultures, they're very good symbols, too. Whereas today in popular culture, you know, if you're watching some of the paranormal shows and everything, the raven is portrayed as an almond. And then, you know, and Edgar Allan Poe didn't help out. But in actuality, the raven is considered the, I guess you could say, the raven is considered a very good symbol, you know, and if you see it as perched, it means that that soul of the deceased has landed on the other side safely. If the raven is in flight, then the family is saying, Raven guide our loved one to the other side. So that's another example where you kind of need to look into the cultural beliefs or the cultural roots of the deceased person.
Now, you know, there was a case I went on in November of last year. I managed to get into an old Mormon cemetery, and I was walking through, and there was one of the most unique stones I've ever seen. It was a very gnarled tree, three-dimensional stone. A ton of work went into this. And I wondered what that meant. It just was so different and out of place and with all the other stones in that were more conventional that you're used to with Pioneer Cemeteries. So I just wondered, what would a tree like that mean? I mean, this thing was 4 feet tall,
yeah,
on a pedestal, and it was just huge, and it dominated the whole cemetery.
I know what you're talking about. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is a fraternal organization. It's called Woodsmen of America, and I believe if you go to that site I gave you about society lists, you'll probably
mm-hmm.
come up with it. Woodsmen of America, I believe, morphed into another society. And most of that goes back into your Great Lake areas where lumberjacking was born. But those people came out, you know, to the west as well, because we have lumberjacks out here in our alpine forest. Woodsmen of America, some of their stones were actually in the form of a tree or a tree stump, and we're talking about elaborate three-dimensional. It actually looks like a tree that's been encased in concrete. Is that kind of what you came across?
Yeah, it was so beautifully done. It was kind of a granite, very tough stone, and I really, there was no other way to put it. It looked like a combination of granite and marble. I really could, and I don't know that, you know, those substances very well, but very durable and hardly any wear on it. And this was a stone from obviously from about 1850, 1860.
Yes.
So
it would represent that the deceased was a member of Woodsmen of America, and that would be the equivalent of, oh, like the Elks Club today or the Lions Club, except that it started out as an organization of lumberjacks. And it was a protective organization. If a lumberjack died, all of the other lumberjacks would come together and help support the family. And that's very common in the early part of America. Teamsters kind of do that today. And you will find symbols on gravestones that represent teamsters. But what was so marvelous about the Woodsmen of America is that their gravestone often was just either in the three-dimensional shape of a tree or a tree trunk. And other than the person's name and pertinent data about birth and death, there may not even be a mention that he was a Woodsman of America, because the symbol of the tree represented that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I remember it clearly. It was just the name and the date, and that was it. And I searched high and low trying to understand, what is this? What does this mean? I've seen one other place in the Coloma area. There's another set of cemeteries there, Pioneer, and I've seen one other like that. But it was nowhere near as good a condition as this one, and it was just this one was just the central feature. It was just unbelievable. And I was just really impressed with it, so it's always stuck in my mind. I'm glad to finally learn
uh-huh.
what that thing meant.
Yeah, and
hey,
mm-hmm.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you can do research on that, or if the family were interested, they could do research on that. One of the reasons it's important to find out if a deceased was a member of a particular organization is that those organizations keep files, and you can go back. You know, Masons are very common today. And I actually contacted a Mason group in Tennessee that my great-grandfather was a member of, and they gave me all sorts of wonderful information on him.
Wow. Okay, well, I'll remember that. We got Kathy asking another question. It says here, has Elizabeth ever heard of the difference in tombstones for the North and South of the Civil War?
Yes. What you're going to find probably in a difference in tombstones is that, and Kathy, all of my ancestry is Southern. You name any state below the Mason-Dixon line, and I have skeletons rattling around there, and I've been to a lot of the old Southern cemeteries. What you're going to find in the Southern cemeteries, other than your classic initials such as UCV, United Confederate Veterans, you'll find others like Sons of the Southern Star, Daughters of the Confederacy. Mine could have many of those on there. But you will find probably a more passionate sense of artwork. And the reason for that is because the largest DNA bank in America is traced right back to the Scots-Irish, and the Scots-Irish pretty much pioneered the largest region of the colonial states, and you're talking about North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, parts of Mississippi, parts of Alabama. You know, and to this day, everyone in America can trace, I should put it this way, predominantly, more people in America can trace their DNA to at least one Scots-Irish DNA than any other cultural background. And within that Scots-Irish DNA, you're going to find this great reverence for the grief and the passion and the belief of the loved one passing over under very gallant circumstances. I have come across some of the most fabulous full-size statuary of angels bent over in just profound grief. Probably more full-size angels than in southern states than absolutely anywhere else in my travels. So I would say that that is probably one distinction you'll find. Real quick, there's this one in Scottsdale, East Texas, which is very much bayou country. I think there's a total population of maybe 25 people in Scottsdale. There is this little Confederate cemetery. The other thing that I have noticed is that the cemeteries are never vandalized, and people actually stop along the side of the road and have picnics there, and then they go through and they weed the cemeteries and so on and so forth. It's just like this. I can't explain it. It's just a reverence for it. So that's the one thing that I have found, in the sense that the cemeteries, the statuary, the graveyards are taken care of on a more personal basis, whereas in other areas, they may be taken care of by a society or an association. But as far as graveyard, you will find some of the most fantastic grave art in southern cemeteries than anywhere else I've ever been.
Now, Kathy was saying here, that the north, she's saying that the north had rounded tops on the tombstones, and the South had pointed tops so that a Yankee couldn't sit on it too long or at all on top of it.
I have never seen that. I think that's a myth. I think, if anything, the pointed tops and the arch tops is very Gothic, and you'll find that everywhere because that was just the whole Gothic Romance movement. The pointed tops make more toward the Puritan movement that you're going to find in the New England states. Do keep in mind that when you go back into colonial aspects, that from Virginia going across the Mason-Dixon line, which includes West Virginia, Kentucky, Missouri, everything below those top states was considered Southern. Most of what was above was Puritan or Northern. And when you get into the New England states, you look at the churches and you're going to have spirals, whereas you look at the various churches within the southern states, you know, it started off very Anglican. You're going to find a lot of Celtic crosses. You're going to find more of the arched, because what you're looking for is the arch that mimics the arch of the church windows. And so, if you look,
I'm going to jump in real quick. We've got 45 seconds left in the show. I mean, we took it right to the end.
Okay.
So I'll tell you what. For the archival, we'll just keep going and. To our audience who's out there, we're going to be dropping off here very shortly in 30 seconds. Just to let you know, next week I'm going to be broadcasting from the Truckee Hotel just before our hunt for the evening. So we're going to be doing that along with the GRI team. And we will see you guys then in the coming week and look forward to having you guys call in and we'll talk about the history of the Truckee Hotel, where I have some family history there. So that said, we'll go ahead and continue on. So bye, everybody. See you off the stream here. And Elizabeth, let's just continue on a little bit because you were just going on, and I'm sorry I had to jump in there.
That's okay. But we are off the air.
Yeah, but we're still recording, so we can continue on, and the folks that download will continue on with that. So, yeah, keep right on with your point, because you're really good. I love listening to you.
Thank you. I have to tell you, I did a paranormal radio show about a month ago, and the host just had the most horrible cold, and she said I was going to cancel, but she said I remembered that you would just do the show for me. So... You know, just keep that in mind, you know. But, yeah, going with the whole arch of, or the pointed, I think that's just a myth. And truly, truly, from my travels, I've seen that the gravestones more often than not will reflect the religious beliefs. And you know the South had a great diversity because what happened is that, first of all, Virginia was founded under... First of all, people, Virginia was founded, Jamestown was founded long before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. It's just that in Virginia they don't promote that. But in Virginia, because it was Anglican, and Anglican is actually Anglican Catholic, they used many more of the Celtic symbols and the great Gothic symbols with your high arched windows, because that whole Gothic thing was it's arched, it's reaching up to the heavens, it's reaching up to God, it's opening up to God. And so you've got that arch going on. And out of Virginia, because Virginia was very liberal, as long as a church that was not Anglican kept really good church records, anyone could come into Virginia and start a church. So in Virginia, mm-hmm. you had Quakers, you had Methodists, Lutherans, you had Baptists, because they were free to worship there as long as the church kept records. And the reason for that is because in the earliest colonial days, property tax was paid at church level. And so, of course, whatever state you were in, they wanted you to keep good records. And so that was the reason that there were so many more different denominations in Virginia and after the Revolutionary War, because... So much of the Revolutionary War was paid off in credit by giving property out. It was paid off that way that the colonists in Virginia and in the Carolinas then went into the other areas because they were given acreage in what became Tennessee or what became Kentucky. And so they took their great diversity of Christian, predominantly Christian religion, although there was some Jewish sects in there, into Kentucky and Tennessee and the other southern states. So, you know, I think, once again, like I said, more people today who have American ancestry, and I'm not just talking about surname, I always tell people, who did that surname marry? Because you're just as much related to the maternal line as you are to the paternal line. Chances are yeah. you've got someone who is Scottish or Irish. It's a great myth that all the Irish came over here in the 1840s during the famine. I actually have an Irishman who was in Jamestown around 1620, and he came over as an indentured servant. His name is John O'Mannon. But I think the pointed stones or the pointed artwork, and you often see this almost like a picture frame. The gravestone will look pointed, and then along the sides there might be columns, and then sort of at the bottom it will have a stepped look, almost like little steps going up to it. That may reflect more of a Puritan frame of reference coming out of New England, And keep in mind that just like the colonies in Virginia went westward, they went over the Appalachian Mountains into West Virginia, Kentucky. Well, in New England, they also went westward into Ohio and the Great Lakes area of, you know, Michigan, and into Illinois and into the Great Northern Plains area. You know, so I tell everyone, when you're looking at your ancestors, if you finally, you know, get back to an area of New England, or you think that that's where they came into, then just go west from there, following the colonization and the Revolution of America, because they went west based on land grants awarded to them for their service in the Revolutionary War. So I, you know, from my experience, I would say there's, it's, you know, it's a cute myth, but it's a myth about pointed headstones as opposed to arched headstones.
You know, you got me wondering, I mean, looking at modern burial practices, here, especially here in this country, you know, I've been laughing a lot with friends because I've kind of, you know, I have a career in computing, but I'm also, you know, here I am, a dedicated paranormal researcher, and I've decided I'm going to poke some fun when I finally, you know, shuffle the mortal coil here. And to have something that basically incorporates my ghost hunting with a few pointed bits of computer humor as I leave the planet. And I wondered if it's a modern kind of tendency for, you know, each age seems to have its own, you know, take on death and how they, you know, do their thing. Have you noticed any trends in the modern era?
Yes, I have. You know, kind of like I mentioned, we're not nearly as religious or even spiritual today. And so often you find, well, here's a classic example, and I don't mind sharing this with you. My mother was not a religious or spiritual person, and she died over a year ago, and there was absolutely no funeral. She died, the coroner came and got her, and that was it. And she was cremated.
Whoa.
And so we are seeing more and more cremations than ever before. And actually up until, I'll tell you who was ahead of that whole cremation kind of thought was the Quakers. One of the things you need to be aware of is that in the colonial time period, the Quaker movement was sort of almost new, what New Age is today.
Yeah.
And the Quakers did not believe in leaving behind any type of sign of their mortal life because they felt it was vain. And so to this day, you may find out if you had a Quaker relative when they were born and when they died, but you will not find their burial ground because Quakers did not put up headstones. And the only reason you may find a general burial site is because it was fenced in and they were in a locality where the local government required that they keep a plat map, but that plat map would have been on paper. And as we all know, paper ages and sometimes disintegrates, or, you know, it gets destroyed in a fire or a weather situation, that kind of
thing.
It can be very, very difficult to find a Quaker burial ground because they did not ever, ever mark graves. That kind of, you know, we still have Quakers today. Here in Southern California, the city of Whittier was founded by Quakers.
So today's society is somewhat matching all that, and probably based on costs and different things with the economy and the way things are. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, it's and oddly enough, my grandmother went through the same thing. I mean, she passed away and was cremated, and it took us 7 years to get a family, you know, spiritual gathering together. And my aunt and we got the whole family together and scattered her ashes where she wanted it done, and that felt very complete. And oddly enough, at the moment of scattering, my niece took a picture with me in it, and right next to me, two brilliant orbs showed up over the scattering. As a matter of fact, I got that. So, you know, I really think it's a disservice not to give these people their ceremony, you know, for life well led, you know.
Yeah, my My father was a religious person. My grandparents all were. I don't know where my mother came into her sense of feeling about things. She was a very functional person. And I don't know if that had something to do with it or not. But my father always said that funerals and the whole concept of burial is for the living and not for the dead. And I feel very strongly about that because of ancestors as possible ghosts. My grandparents, I think, had a sense of humor. And my grandparents are buried in Colton, California, in the same cemetery as Morgan Earp.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, a very small little cemetery. And Colton is a very historic Old West town. The Earps did live there. And my grandparents lived just right around the corner from Virgil Earp, the older brother of Wyatt and Morgan. And Virgil was a law enforcement out here in the Colton area. And their stepmom, who they considered their mom, Virginia Cooksey Earp, is buried in San Bernardino. But anyway, my grandparents had specifically requested that their gravestones say, "Gone but not forgotten." And I can tell you, they are gone, but they are not forgotten.
I see that a lot out here, over and over again, that same phrase. I didn't realize. Yeah, I've seen it on at least 20 different graves, and I like that.
I like that
a lot.
Yeah, and my grandparents died in 1968 and 1970, so that's not that long ago. But I definitely feel, and as far as spirit visitation goes, I definitely feel that they are gone but not forgotten. You know, so I think there is, and yet they were not, they were kind of like the salt of the earth, Waltons kind of, if you remember the old show, The Waltons?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
It's, you know, like John Boy and all of that, it's still shown on TV every now and then. They were that kind of very quiet people. They were not overtly religious, although they were religious. They were just very humble, kind of quiet people. But I think that phrase, gone but not forgotten, spoke volumes to me when they died, because I was young when they died. And I thought, and to this day, I still think, they're watching over us, and they wanted us to know that.
I agree with that. I have an uncle who passed 20-some-odd years back, and oddly enough, every so often, I will start thinking of him, and I feel him there, and I know that he's in visitation and he's checking out, and it's just, you could almost see him nodding and going, "Okay, yeah, you're doing good. I'll go away now."
Yeah, I agree with that, and you know, and that's why so often I have been the guest, and we do the whole thing about, you know, are your ancestors your ghosts? Because I think you feel this way, because I want people to understand, if they feel a haunting, that, and unless something has happened that's truly dramatic and negative, it might be a spirit visitation trying to communicate with you, and it could be someone very dear to you who has passed on, a relative, a good friend, you know, something of that nature. And in that case, you want them to feel welcomed in the sense that you are paying attention to them, because I feel very strongly that love does not die, it transcends. And that those people who loved us may come back into our lives now and then at a time that we really need them.
Well, oddly enough, I mean, that's sort of what we have come to the conclusion with my father's, you know, stroke situation. And every time we go through a major event with him, the activity here kicks up dramatically, paranormally. And we've come to the conclusion that it is family checking in. And that's exactly mirrors the theory, you know, the theory my mother and I have had. And we've actually come to identify the different spirits as past relatives.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to respond to us when we call them by name. So
yeah.
We're very clear. As a matter of fact, of all people, I talked to Chip Coffey about it. I was hunted with him in September, mm-hmm. over on the USS Hornet. And wow, you know, And he can basically confirm that. He says, yeah, that's relatives showing up. You know, they're helping you. Hey, by the way, I just wanted to let you know, Blog Talk might drop you off. So if it happens, I just wanted to thank you for being on. So, I mean, we're just talking through, but I think they go like with a 2-hour total on the show. So if it does drop off, you know, I loved having you on, and I will have you on again because you are such a great guest. And,
well, thank you. I will be contacting radio hosts again probably in February or March. I try to take most of December and January off for two reasons. First of all, I live in deep snow area. I'm up here by Big Bear in the San Bernardino Mountains.
I know right where you're at.
Yeah, and our utilities are such that I just can't count on them. And we don't have cell phone service up here. I have to rely on ground. And
okay.
It's just so frustrating to me to get into a position where I know I'm going to be on the radio and I don't know if I'm going to have phone service. So it's like, oh my gosh, I can't even get through on the computer to let them know. That's only happened once, and the person was forewarned, you know, that it could happen, but I just don't like to leave anyone in a lurch. And I just kind of need the time off because I do use deep winter for doing research on the novel that I start writing on March 1st.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, I would love to have you on in that time frame. So if we could, you know, I'll get with you on email and,
sure.
You know, see if we can arrange that because you are such a great guest. And thank you so much for talking because my voice, I mean, I've been fighting a coughing all night and it's just that H1N1, trust me, you do not want this. It was,
yeah.
I was 7 days flat on my back and oh, goodness gracious.
I'm trying not to get it, but what can you do, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, just stay away from anybody who's sick, because that's how we got it. We ended up at the hospital with my father, and the next thing we knew, a week later, we were down. I'm going to go ahead and post these links on the website and then your contact information. So we'll just, you know, take that as kind of a little article in this, and something that not only my researcher, I think she's going to love a lot of this stuff. I'm going to take it to her.
Yeah.
But definitely, just thank you so much for coming on, you know, Elizabeth.
Oh,
it's just a pleasure to have you.
I loved it. And John, if you ever come across any other paranormal host on radio, let them know about me, because I try to share as much of this information from the genealogical point of view, but also from the paranormal investigator point of view, and you can always email me if you have a question.
Okay, and your email, is it the ghostmystery@usa.com?
Well, ghostmysteryusa is the one connected to my website.
Okay.
So that's the one that I check most often. But
okay.
The other one that you had emailed me at, that one too. But through my website, and you don't have to put Shannon Delaney in there. Just put Ghost Rider or John.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
All right. All right. Well, we will take it from there then. And so I just thank you again for coming on. And, you know, we had a pretty good audience tonight, and I really think the downloads are going to be fast and plenty for this show. They're going to love hearing the extra stuff we did here. So thank you for staying on a bit longer with us. And, you know, I wish you a lot of luck over the, you know, the holiday break here for you and the research and the stuff you're doing. Oddly enough, I'm going to be doing something similar. You know, we're going to be catching up on our evidence. And I'm building a teardrop trailer that's going to be towed behind my little 05 Mustang. And that's going to be the GRI paranormal trailer, and also a way of not spending money on a lot of hotels. And so that's going to be my special project. So I'll tell you all about it in the email and share a few pictures. But I'll be definitely looking forward to your books here, and The Ghost Meets an Angel. As soon as that comes out, I'm going to grab a copy. So we're looking forward to that.
Real quick, A Ghost Meets an Angel has grave statuary on the cover. And there's this story about, I'll have to go over that another time, but it had to do with a ghost tour I took in Natchez, Mississippi, and it's called The Turning Angel. But that same statuary is in County Cork, Ireland, where I have ancestry. And I just
all
know
right.
to be. So thank you very, very much. Happy Halloween.
Okay, you too. God bless. And thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. And this is Ghostwriter Paranormal Radio. We're going to be signing off. And, you know, again, a very fascinating interview with Elizabeth Eakin Cox, just a treasure. This woman is extremely intelligent, as you can very well tell. I'm going to go ahead and take all of the – I took a copious notes here for the show notes. I will, after our investigation is over tomorrow and I get back Sunday morning, I'm going to translate this all into some general notes here and put up an article on the GRI website and give you all something to be able to look up. So just pay attention probably by Monday of next week. Look for an article on Elizabeth Eakin Cox interview of October, and we will have all of these links and more available for you to download and really partake of this woman's knowledge. This show I would rate in the top 10 we've ever done, just because of the things that I just learned so much listening to her. This is truly a resource for the whole paranormal community, what she is and what she does. So with that, we're going to go ahead and sign off. I don't have the control panel to do our sign-off music, so I can't even sing right now. I'm still a little bit coming off this bug that I have. But we're going to go ahead and sign off and see you next week from the Truckee Hotel. So this is Ghostwriter Paranormal Radio signing off.